we speak, a curfew has just taken effect in and around Minneapolis and St. Paul, including here in Brooklyn Center, Minnesota. Mourners and protesters not going anywhere at the moment. The outpouring and curfew come in response to civil unrest after police in this Minneapolis suburb shot and killed a black man, Dante Wright, during a traffic stop over the weekend. Just moments ago, the county medical examiner ruled his death a homicide. It was not the only item along those lines, though. Also over the weekend, video emerged of an Army lieutenant pepper sprayed and roughed up by police outside Norfolk, Virginia, after admitting he was too terrified to get out of his car during a traffic stop late last year. "I'm honestly afraid to get out," he's heard to say. In response, one of the officers tells him, "Yeah, you should be." And as if to emphasize that fear cuts both ways, two police officers were shot and wounded early this morning during a high-speed chase west of Atlanta. All of this, of course, is happening with the Twin Cities already on edge as the prosecution continues to make its case against a former Minneapolis police officer in the killing of George Floyd. President Biden spoke to the moment and the mood this afternoon.
"Are you concerned things could be on a razor's edge, sir?"
"I'm not going to speculate now. I'm hopeful that there will be a verdict and an outcome that will be supported by the vast majority of the people in the region, and that's my expectation."
Well, shortly before airtime, the president tweeted this message, quote, "Today I'm thinking about Dante Wright and his family and the pain, anger, and trauma that black America experiences every day. While we await a full investigation, we know what we need to do to move forward, rebuild trust, and ensure accountability so no one is above the law." CNN's Adrian Brodus is in Brooklyn Center, Minnesota's for us tonight. So, Adrian, Dante Wright's death was ruled a homicide in just the last hour. I'm curious what reaction people there on the ground had and what's the latest you're seeing there.
You know, people here on the ground, Anderson, are upset. At this hour, Sam Cooke's "A Change Is Gonna Come" is playing in the background as these protesters take over the streets here in Brooklyn Center. The group here wants to know, when will that change come? They're talking about the trial of Derek Chauvin taking place about 10 miles away from here for the death of George Floyd. And here, they had to hear once again, another black man died at the hands of police. And I want to warn you, the video you're about to see is disturbing. Around 2 p.m. local time Sunday, police pulled over Wright. The police chief says they stopped Dante Wright because he had an expired registration on his license plate. The release footage begins minutes into the stop and shows police walking up to the car, and then Wright is seen stepping out of his vehicle. Police then tried to take Wright into custody after discovering he has an outstanding warrant. The video shows Wright begins to resist as cuffs are placed on him and he gets back into the vehicle.
"As I watch the video and listen to the officer's commands, it is my belief that the officer had the intention to deploy their taser, but instead shot Mr. Wright with a single bullet. This appears to me, from what I've viewed and the officer's reaction and distress immediately after, that this was an accidental discharge that resulted in the tragic death of Mr. Wright. The officer is currently on administrative leave."
Wright drove several blocks before hitting another vehicle, according to police. Police and medical personnel attempted life-saving measures following the crash, but Wright died at the scene.
"I heard the police officer come to the window."
Wright's mother, Katie, told CNN affiliate Care TV she was on the phone with her son before the shooting. It's unclear to CNN how Katie Wright knew police had hung up the phone. Protests erupted in a suburb outside Minneapolis in the aftermath of the shooting. Hundreds taking to the streets Sunday night, clashing with police. The National Guard was also on the scene. The situation turned violent. Crowds marching toward the police department swarmed police cars and started destroying them. Police moved in to disperse the crowds. The chief of police also said bricks and frozen soda cans were thrown at officers, injuring one who was taken to the hospital. And while one group stayed at the police department, a second group of protesters went to a strip mall where businesses were broken into and looted.
"We recognize that this couldn't have happened at a worse time."
The city of Brooklyn Center is only about 10 miles from where former police officer Derek Chauvin is on trial for the killing of George Floyd. The chief of police says he released the footage to be transparent and became emotional when I asked what was on his heart.
"I'm the leader of this department. They expect me to lead, create a safe city. That's what I'm trying to do. So that's it.
I hope you're not crying, too.
Okay. And, yeah, I'm emotional.
Adrian, for the officer who shot Dante Wright, what is their status in the department? Are they still on active duty?
The officer who shot Dante Wright is on administrative leave, but members of the community are calling for her to be fired, and they're also asking, they say demanding, the chief of police in Brooklyn Center resign. Anderson?
Adrian Brodus, appreciate your reporting. Thank you. Joining us now, CNN senior legal analyst and former federal prosecutor Laura Coates. Also CNN contributor, former FBI Deputy Director Andrew McCabe, and CNN law enforcement analyst Charles Ramsey, former top cop in Philadelphia and the District of Columbia. Chief Ramsey, from a policing standpoint, can you explain how this could have happened and how officers are trained to avoid a tragic mistake like this?
Well, first of all, it shouldn't have happened. The taser, in fact, if you go back to 2009, Fruitville Station in Oakland, the BART officer that shot the individual as he had him down, he was carrying his taser and his firearm on the same side. From that point on, every department I'm aware of now, they require officers to wear the taser on the opposite side, the weak side, away from the gun. So it's a cross draw, making it very, very difficult, if not impossible, to make that kind of mistake. What happened here? I have no idea. The taser was on the opposite side, as it should be. She drew it, or at least drew a firearm, thinking, in at least that's what she's saying, that it was the taser fired the shot. It should not happen. It was negligence, no question about it. Training and everything else should have kicked in. She's a veteran, not a rookie. It just should not have happened.
It's so interesting because as you see in the video, you hear her saying, I believe it's her, the officer saying, taser, 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 which I guess is
right.
What you're supposed to say before you fire a taser. And you see the gun. I assume she will argue that in the heat of the moment with adrenaline pumping and, as you say, she, though, is an experienced officer, she says she believed it was a taser that she was firing.
Well, it's still negligence. Again, she yelled taser as she's supposed to do, but she didn't pull her taser. She pulled a firearm. So it's clearly negligence that's involved in this case. Now, whether or not she's charged or not, I don't know. It certainly is possible in Minnesota. We know that's one of the charges against Derek Chauvin. So it's very possible that she might be charged. But that's up to the district attorney or attorney general to make that type of decision. But it just shouldn't have happened. It is just pure negligence on her part.
Andrew, in a case like this, too, and we've seen a number of cases where the underlying charge or the underlying suspicion or the reason somebody was pulled over in the first place is often relatively minor compared to what ends up happening, resulting in a death. When you see this entire interaction, what stands out to you?
Boy, Anderson, so many things stand out to me. There's the issue that you just raised. You have a young man who was pulled over for driving on a tag that bore an expired registration. I mean, that every one of us who's driven a car before has been pulled over for something like that. That typically is a window roll down, and a police officer tells you to get your paperwork in order and sends you on your way. In this case, they also discovered that he had an outstanding warrant for a misdemeanor, not even a felony warrant. So really, really hard questions to be answered here tonight by those officers about why they took an incredibly minor situation like this and escalated it to that level. And I would say also to tag on to Chief Ramsey's comments, which I agree with wholeheartedly, there are other mistakes here. They made the choice to get him out of the vehicle and then let him stand right in front of the open door instead of walking him to the back of the vehicle. They basically created a situation where he had easy access to get back in the car, and then everything, now you have a much bigger problem on your hands. So lots of very tough questions to be answered.
And Laura, if someone is trying to flee from a traffic stop, which is what he seemed to be doing, legally, what are officers allowed to do? Because courts have looked into this.
Well, Yeah, the courts have. In fact, the Supreme Court's looked into it, and they have said already very clearly that a fleeing suspect still deserves to have the use of force continuum applied. You don't just get to use deadly force or some sort of excessive force or even force in general to pursue a fleeing suspect unless there is some basis to believe that the amount of force you're using is reasonable, necessary, and proportional. In other words, you cannot substitute deadly force for cardiovascular activities of pursuit. The idea here being that you have to still judge and reassess the use of force you're using. This probably sounds familiar, Anderson, to people watching because we've been dealing with this for the better part of 2 weeks in the Derek Chauvin trial, this force continuum. Nothing about the calculus changes, even if the person does have a warrant, short of being somebody in an active pursuit of an ongoing deadly shooting spree or a crime of some sort. Officers need to actually assess the amount of force they're using. And so what you see here, the tragedy of this, as Andrew was talking about and Commissioner Ramsey, the idea of going from an expired tab of some sorts to this notion without any justification or reasonable use of force. And as President Biden has said, the investigation as to whether it indeed was an accident or not, unfortunately, because of a trust gap in our community and the ideas of the police officers, that will have to be explored.
Well, Laura, I mean, the chief of police says that the officer in question here is a, quote, very senior officer, called it an accidental discharge. The medical examiner has now ruled Mr. Wright's death a homicide. Do you expect to see charges in the case? I mean, the case Chief Ramsey mentioned in Oakland, California, the officer involved was convicted of involuntary manslaughter after he said he mistook his firearm for a taser and shot and killed Oscar Grant.
That's true. And of course, there were some other factors and nuances to that case that might make it distinct from this one, in that there was other testimony to suggest that perhaps one of the officers involved may not have believed that they were mistakenly drawing a taser. I don't know that to be the case here and here. But what I do know is the term negligence has a legal definition. You know, the idea, it has to be that somebody was aware of some appreciable risk and they consciously disregarded it for some reason, or they created an opportunity that they created a substantial risk to human life. And so if there was something about the placement of this taser that ran counter to the training, if there was something about what she did in terms of moving in towards the driver's seat and using her weapon, whether it was a taser or a firearm, we know it was a firearm, if there's something about her approach to this particular suspect that goes off of the use of force, and of course we know that a 20-year-old has now died, well then that's part of the legal terminology around negligence. But there could be other charges, or there could be less. Remember the powerful police union. This officer has not yet been fired. We don't know if she will be on administrative leave. And we heard that chief, with Adrian's great question, that that officer was due process. I would note what was not afforded to Mr. Wright.
Yeah. Laura Coates, Andrew McCabe, Charles Ramsey, thank you. Laura's going to stay with us because we have more to talk about, including the closing witnesses for the prosecution in the Chauvin trial, George Floyd's brother taking the stand. And later, Senator Bernie Sanders joins us with his take on events and his assessment as Budget Committee Chairman of criticism of the president's infrastructure spending plan, mostly over what is infrastructure and what isn't. We'll be right back. Even before tonight's curfew was declared in and around the Twin Cities, big area sports teams called off games, the Twins postponing their home game with the Boston Red Sox, as did the NBA Timberwolves and NHL's Minnesota Wild, all teams citing the killing of Dante Wright as the reason. Meantime, in the killing of George Floyd, the prosecution is expected to wrap up and the defense begin its case tomorrow. Today saw more expert testimony on the use of force and cause of death, but the most notable witness was an expert in neither, only in what it's like to lose a brother. More from CNN's Sarah Seidner.
He was a big mama's boy.
George Floyd's brother, Philonis Floyd, took the stand to tell the jurors who his brother was before his death, sparked worldwide protests.
He just was like a person that everybody loved around the community. He just knew how to make people feel better.
In May 2020, Floyd uttered the word mama several times before he died.
He loved her so dearly.
His brother says Floyd was crushed when his mother died in May 2018.
George just sat there at the casket over and over again. He would just say, mama, mama, over and over again. And I didn't know what to tell him because I was in pain too. We all were hurting. And he was just kissing her. He didn't want to leave the casket.
Floyd's family testimony is one of the last the jurors heard in the prosecution's case.
The state will call Dr. Jonathan Rich.
The prosecution started the day calling another medical expert, Dr. Jonathan Rich, an expert in cardiology, determined Floyd died because of the officer's actions.
Do you have an opinion as to whether George Floyd would have lived if not for Mr. Chauvin's subdual and restraint of him for 9 minutes and 29 seconds on the ground?
Yes, I believe he would have lived.
Again, Chauvin's attorney tried to get the doctor to admit there were other possibilities for Floyd's death, such as drugs or heart disease, and one more thing, Floyd's own actions.
If Mr. Floyd had simply gotten in the back seat of the squad car, do you think that he would have survived?
Had he not been restrained in the way in which he was, I think he would have survived that day.
The prosecution is expected to rest soon. Then it will be the defense's turn to try and unravel the prosecution's case with their own witnesses. The prosecution again played the video of Floyd being detained for the jury as they questioned another use of force expert.
Looking at the threat analysis here, it's clear from the number of officers and Mr. Floyd's position, the fact that he's handcuffed and has been searched, he doesn't present a threat of harm.
Before the jurors arrived to court, Chauvin's attorney, Eric Nelson, presented an argument to the court that the jurors should be sequestered because of a recent officer-involved shooting just outside Minneapolis. Less than 24 hours before court began, police killed a young black man named Dante Wright, sparking fresh protests and riots in Brooklyn Center.
This incident, while it is, I understand it's not this case. I understand that it is not involved, that it does not involve these same parties. But the problem is that the emotional response that that case creates sets the stage for a jury to say, I'm not going to vote not guilty because I'm concerned about the outcome.
The judge denied the request to sequester the jury, and the case continued unabated.
Doing closings, so I will proceed.
And Sarah Seidner joins us now. Do we know what else the prosecution has planned and when exactly the defense is expected to start the presentation?
Yeah, the judge expects the defense to start their case tomorrow. We have not gotten an official end to the prosecution's case, but we expect it to come tomorrow when the judge says that the defense is expected to start its case. And I do want to mention where I'm standing. I'm actually standing in the spot where Dante Wright took some of his last breaths. And just behind me over my left shoulder there, you will see a fist standing strong there. That was actually the original fist that was brought out to George Floyd Square, right near where George Floyd died. A lot of these folks who were here were there protesting his death. Now they're here protesting yet another death at the hands of police.
Sarah Seidner, thanks so much. Appreciate it. Back with Laura Coates, and joining us is criminal defense attorney Mark O'Mara. So, Laura, we heard both very technical testimony from the cardiologist today and other experts, and obviously the very emotional testimony that Mr. Floyd's brother gave. I'm wondering, do you expect one to have a bigger impact on the jury than the other?
Well, you know, what's odd here, Anderson, is most people would tell you, how is it that a family member is able to testify if they were not an eyewitness, if they were not an expert witness? Minnesota has a pretty unique doctrine called the spark of life that essentially says a murder victim, you're able to call a witness that gives some character evidence about that person to bring them to life as not somebody who, the phrasing is, just bones and sinews, the idea of humanizing the person for the jury. And this is very, very important, of course, because we've heard from his girlfriend at the time before he passed away. We heard her testimony. We heard about the different people who were bystanders. Even one person during the video shouting, but he's a human being, though. And this consistent theme of trying to make sure people know that although he has become an illustrative symbol of officer-involved shootings or deaths of unarmed black men and women across this country, that this case was specifically about the death of George Floyd and making it a point of reference as opposed to one about greater society, which can cut both ways, as you saw today from the defense attempt to try to sequester the jury.
Mark, is that common in courtrooms around the country, that allowing somebody to come in and play that role to kind of humanize a victim? Because the defense chose not to cross-examine the brother, which I imagine you would agree with their decision there.
Definitely.
They would, from the defense standpoint, they would want him off the stand, I guess, as quickly as possible.
Absolutely true. You do not want to cross-examine a family member like that, although there are times when you do need to. But having said that, no, it is unique. There are not many states that allow that type of what's called spark of life testimony, which is personalizing the victim of a homicide in front of the jury. And I think it's extraordinarily compelling the way it was presented, because in fact, that's what you want. You want that jury to have as one of the last witnesses from the state the idea of a family member, a brother coming in and talking about that now decedent, because that's just so compelling. Every one of those jurors has a family member. And the idea of connecting like that with a brother is very compelling, and it's going to sit with them throughout the rest of the trial, which is exactly what the prosecution wants.
I should point out the images our viewers are seeing from our two affiliates is in Brooklyn Center in Minnesota, people gathering outside the police station. As you know, there's a curfew that is now in effect, but people are remaining. And obviously, there's a heavy police presence on the ground there. Laura, the cardiologist testified that if Mr. Floyd had not been restrained in the way that he was, he would have survived that day. His testimony lines up with what we heard from other medical experts so far. Do you expect the defense, who begins their case tomorrow, to try to have their own expert witnesses to try to rebut what we heard already on the medical front? Because clearly they have been trying to poke holes in it, or at least raise the suggestion that, well, pre-existing heart conditions, drug use played a role.
Oh, they're going to need to. I mean, the idea of allowing the testimony of not only all of the laymen and the bystanders and the law enforcement officials and the use of force experts, but the pulmonologist, the forensic pathologist, the medical examiner, the idea of a cardiologist, another now constitutional law scholar, the weight that is against Derek Chauvin is not coincidental. The prosecutors do not intend to do any favors to the defendant in a way to make him avoid having to testify. You see, they've now allowed the jury to linger with that question and to wrestle with the question of why didn't this officer know what so many others from laymen and beyond know? Now, what they're going to have to do is say, look, we've got our own experts here, and they actually look at this video differently. They view his heart and lung arrest, the cardiopulmonary arrest, differently. They view that enlarged heart differently. They view the use of force as far more subjective than what's being talked about as best practices. Because if they don't prove that, if they allow it just to linger and fester in the minds of the jury, the question will be, well, why are you the lone person across the spectrum who did not understand that what you were doing was applying deadly force unnecessarily, unreasonably, even when people implored you to stop?
Mark, at this point, with the defense taking over now to make their defense, how much of what they plan to do is already set in stone, and how much have they now had to kind of recalibrate based on what has already occurred in the court?
So most of it is set in stone at this point, because obviously part of what the defense does is find out what the state is doing, see how well they did it, and then find the holes, find the cracks in that armor, because that's where they're going to find the argument of reasonable doubt, and which is why we've had a state sort of preempt a lot of that by being so very particular, meticulous, maybe almost over the top in bringing out these experts. The cardiologist may be considered to be sort of over the top because we've heard it before. But I got to tell you, I thought that the expert they brought in, the professor, did a great job because, as Laura just said, he has now said probably 24 times, a reasonable officer would have done this. A reasonable officer would have done that. So it almost begs the question of who is going to say why Chauvin did it, if not for Chauvin himself. The defense is going to bring in their experts, sort of, if you think about it, almost chapter by chapter by chapter, they have to respond to what the state did. But the bottom line is they've got to find reasonable doubt in the cause of death, which they've tried throughout all the cross-examination, and try and convince one, two, or three jurors that the state's case is not as pristine as they make it sound by a presentation of their own experts.
Yeah. Mark O'Mara, Laura Coates, appreciate it. Thank you. We have breaking news just ahead, the latest on a shooting at a high school in Knoxville, Tennessee. And later, a talk with Sabrina Fulton, the Trayvon Martin's mom, 9 years after he was shot and killed. What resonates with her today as a convergence of violence against people of color once again dominates the headlines. As today's developments cascade upon one another, it's important to point out that if anyone knows the pain associated with the killing of a loved one that blossomed into one of the highest profile trials in recent history, it's Sabrina Fulton. She's the mother of Trayvon Martin, 17-year-old young man who was killed in February of 2012 by a neighborhood watchman named George Zimmerman, who was ultimately found not guilty of second-degree murder. Sabrina Fulton became an activist and a public speaker, and she joins me now. Ms. Fulton, thanks for being with us. Today we heard from the family of George Floyd, his brother testifying in court. You testified, as I recall, in the trial of the man who shot your son. It must take an incredible amount of strength to take that stand.
It absolutely does, Anderson. First of all, thank you for having me. But it just bothers you to have to relive the tragedy over and over and over. That's what the family is going through right now. The trauma of just experiencing, just seeing the visual of that just over and over and over again is very traumatic.
Your organization, the Trayvon Martin Foundation, works to bring together families who've lost their children through violence. I mean, every time there's a new video, another person's death is played over and over. I can't imagine the impact that has on people who have been left behind and other mothers and fathers and family members who have experienced the same kind of thing. It must just bring it all back.
Absolutely. We call it triggers because it triggers what we've already gone through. A lot of people call them stories, but it's not a story for us because we have to live with this our entire life. It doesn't go away, and we can't go to the next story and then the next story and then the next story. This is a tragedy that we have to experience, and then we have to struggle with grieving and then our entire life. We have to heal from what we've gone through and just to see it happen over and over and over again. I mean, it's very hurtful.
You know, there have been so many calls and talk about police reforms, about changes that can be made, that should be made, and there have been changes along the way. Has it been enough?
Absolutely not. If we can see a video of a man being killed, a man's last breath, a man calling out for his mother, we definitely need to do some more reforms. We definitely need to make sure that we have different policies and procedures and they're being enforced. And I think that's the problem. I think we have policies and procedures in place, but they're not being enforced. So we have to witness people being killed, people being shot in the back, people with a knee on their neck, people just for trivial things being killed. I mean, people's lives, it seems to me, are just nonchalant when it comes to certain people, you know, and that's people of color. And, you know, we got to be more mindful of what's going on right now. And we can't ignore what we're seeing.
It's been 9 years since your son Trayvon was killed. His killing helped lead to the Black Lives Matter movement. What do you think needs to happen moving forward now?
I think they still, it needs to be more awareness, but we still need more action, not only from the police department as far as reform is concerned, but more action from organizations that are supposed to be in place to help these families, to help these organizations. And so we just got to keep pushing forward. Black Lives Matter needs to be doing a lot more than what they're doing just to try to help and to decrease a lot of these things that are happening with these tragedies in these families.
When it comes to race and justice on a national level, President Biden campaigned on the promise of creating a White House-led policing commission. His administration just announced today that they won't be moving forward with commission, but support making the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act into law. Is that a step in the right direction, you think?
I think that's a step in the right direction, but they definitely need a committee as an oversight committee so that they can help move things a little further. I mean, we can't just sit around and just watch people being killed. It doesn't matter what color you are, but we shouldn't be so comfortable with watching people being killed. As I look at the video of George Floyd, I think about children's rights, women's rights, civil rights, but what about George Floyd, basic human right? And we have to get back to the basics. What about human rights? Just the fact that was an adult male, that was not an animal that was on the ground. That was a human being, and his life was taken right before us. And after we saw that video, we couldn't take it back. We couldn't unsee what we had already saw. And that's why it's affecting so many people.
Sabrina Fulton, I appreciate you being with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Up next, we have breaking news about another shooting, this time at a high school in Knoxville, Tennessee. The latest when we continue. There is more breaking news tonight involving another shooting, this time at a high school in Knoxville, Tennessee, where police say gunfire was exchanged between police and the shooter. Nick Valencia joins us now with the latest. So what do we know about how this shooting unfolded?
Yeah, hey there, Anderson. We just got an update a short time ago from the State Bureau of Investigations, and they tell us that local Knoxville police responded to reports of a male subject armed on campus, believed to be a teenage student at the high school. When Knoxville police arrived at the scene, he was in one of the restrooms there of the high school. They exchanged some words with him, according to police, and that's when he fired, they say, at an officer, striking him in the leg. Officers returned fire, they say, striking the suspect dead. He was pronounced dead at the scene. And that's how it really all unfolded, according to TBI.
And any more information about the officer who was injured?
Yeah, he sustained non-life-threatening injuries. He was transferred to UT Medical Center, according to the police chief, Eve Thomas, there in Knoxville. As of about 30 minutes ago, they say he was in surgery. His condition is serious, and she's asking for prayers. And, you know, Anderson, she mentioned something pretty chilling during the press conference a short time ago, saying that this was sort of a nightmare scenario, not only getting the call that there was a shooting on a high school campus, but also the call that there was an officer down. It took about 2 hours to secure the scene before Knoxville County, or the Knox County superintendent, said that parents and guardians could show up at the school. Yeah, no doubt, tearful reunions with those students there. School shooting, anytime you hear something like that, it's a parent's worst nightmare. And of course, that was underscored by the police chief there in Knoxville. We know that for the next 2 days, school is going to be closed, and we still don't know a clear motive yet. But one really interesting fact being reported by local affiliate WATE is that since the start of the year, you know, we're just 4 months into the year here, and this is the fifth related shooting to that East Austin Magnet High School in Knoxville. So a lot of stuff happening there for the school in a very short amount of time into the school year. Anderson?
And just to be clear, because I'm a little confused, was this person a student at the school, and did somebody see them with a gun, or how was it the police got there in the first place?
Yeah, they didn't really clarify that, and it's believed to be that the student, or that the suspect, I should say, was believed to be a student at the high school. We did put in a call to the high school. They say school goes until about 3 o'clock. The first calls that police got were about 3:15 when they responded. So that's what we know at this point. TBI is still investigating, still trying to gather more details. There were body cameras worn and surveillance footage that they're going to be reviewing, Anderson.
Nick Valencia, I appreciate all the details. Thanks so much. There appears to be more activity in the Brooklyn Center, Minnesota, where the curfew that's been in effect for about 45 minutes or so. CNN's Shimon Prokipes is there for us now. Shimon, what is the scene?
So Anderson, we're here live outside the police station where there was that confrontation with police last night. And there are thousands of people gathered around us here. As you can see, I'm here right up against the fence, Anderson. A lot of the protesters have been coming to the fence, screaming at the police. The police at one point, several of them just gathered around. They called in more reinforcements in those yellowish neon colors. They call them in to try and push some of these protesters back. And then some of the protesters start running when they think the police are about to come this way, as you can see what they're doing here. It is well past curfew, so it's unclear what the police are going to ultimately do here. But certainly right now, the police are standing back and allowing them to remain on the street. At some point, it appears as though the police will come through this gate here, through this fencing. Someone just threw a stick at the police here. And as you can see, this is kind of been the scene out here, Anderson, for the last 45 minutes or so, with many of them coming to the fence, raising their hands, saying, "Don't shoot." And the police are just standing around right now, trying to figure out really what they're going to do. If they're going to force them to leave, because it is well past curfew. But right now, Anderson, It does not appear that the police are going to ask them to leave or disperse. We're waiting to see if police ultimately do that. But right now, they are not doing that. They are just standing there. And I just want to show you some more shots. Here's an announcement here, Anderson, from the police. And so, Anderson, they're announcing the curfew now. And here we go. Here, the police are now moving in. And you see this one officer, Anderson, he's holding, this is what they shoot the tear gas. So the question now is, will the police force them back? So we're going to move back here, Anderson.
And Shimon, is this the first time tonight that the police have moved outside of the area of their station? Or it looks like now they're not?
So, yes, this is, well, at least it's the first time that they've come close to doing so. You can see them throwing a water bottle here. More water bottles being thrown. So far, the police have been fairly restrained. They've been staying behind these fences. As you just heard, they made that announcement for people announcing that there's a curfew. So right now, everyone is just sort of standing around waiting to see what will happen. But yeah, Anderson, that was the first time since I've been standing here that the police showed any sort of movement that they were going to try to disperse them. And now you could see, Anderson, the crowd is starting to go again towards the fence. And we will see what the police here do.
Okay. Shimon,
police are just standing back, Anderson.
Yeah. We'll continue to monitor this with you and with your images. I want to bring in Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, who joins us. Senator Sanders, thanks so much for being with us. I want to talk to you about infrastructure and the president's plans. But just given what's going on right now in Minnesota, obviously, we've seen another deadly encounter with police unfold this weekend, just miles away from where the Chauvin trial is ongoing. What do you make of what we are witnessing?
I'm sorry. Are you talking to me, Anson?
Yeah, sorry. I'm sorry, Senator. It's okay. We want to talk about infrastructure with you and the Biden administration talking about their infrastructure plans. But before we do, we just had a report and we have some pictures up from Brooklyn Center in Minnesota, where a large number of demonstrators have gathered, and there's a police station that they are outside of now. Given what we've seen just in the last couple of days in terms of the death of another person at the hands of police and the Chauvin trial going on, can more be done?
This is a movie. This is a tragic movie that we have seen over and over and over again, countless times. And I think the word has got to get out. We need major, major police department reform. Lethal force has got to be the very last resort. We need police departments that reflect the demographics of the communities they serve. Our police officers must be held accountable for their actions. And we need to redefine what police do. So there's an enormous amount of work that has to be done to make sure that police departments are constructive and not destructive forces within their communities.
President Biden had campaigned on forming a commission on police reforms, on policing. Is that something you would like to see happen?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, it's a very long discussion, but the bottom line is that we need major, major reform in so many respects in terms of police departments all across this country.
On infrastructure, the Biden administration says it's open to negotiation around its $2 trillion infrastructure package. How confident are you that can actually happen when so many Republicans in Congress remain beholden to the former president and continue to peddle, you know, the big lie and conspiracy theories? Do you trust them to negotiate?
Well, the devil will be in the details. And if Republicans are serious about wanting to create millions of jobs, rebuilding our crumbling roads and bridges and wastewater plants and so forth, that's great. If they are serious about working with us to transform our energy system away from fossil fuel so we can combat climate change, that would be great. frankly, between you and me, I have my doubts that that will happen. But, you know, our goal is not to negotiate for a very long period of time. We have crises facing this country. We've got to create millions of good paying jobs. We must combat climate change. You got to build millions of units and retrofit units of affordable housing. And in my view, when we talk about infrastructure, Anderson, we're not just talking about physical infrastructure, as important as that is, roads and bridges, etc. We're talking about human infrastructure.
But there's also, on that point, there is this battle going on right now to define what infrastructure is. You and other Democrats are arguing things like home health care, job training should fall under the umbrella of infrastructure. There are others who say those are clearly not infrastructure. Is the definition accurate?
I think the definition of infrastructure are the goods and services and structures that maintain a society. And when you define infrastructure in that way, to me, if a mom and dad go to work in the morning, you know what? They have the right to know that their children, their little kids, are going to be in quality childcare that they can afford. When I talk about infrastructure, I am talking about the fact that today in America, it's unbelievable. You got millions of senior citizens who have no teeth in their mouth, unable to digest the food that they are eating. They cannot hear well and are isolated from their kids and grandchildren and their communities. They can't hear. And people have trouble seeing because the cost of dental care, the cost of eyeglasses, the cost of hearing aids is astronomically high. And we got to deal with that. And that's why I am fighting to expand Medicare to include dental care, eyeglasses, hearing aids, lower the age of eligibility for Medicare to 60. And we pay for that by finally having the courage, Anderson, to take on the greed of the pharmaceutical industry, which charges us by far the highest prices in the world for prescription drugs. So if we can have Medicare negotiate prescription drug prices, we will save approximately $450 billion over a 10-year period, which will enable us to expand Medicare, provide dental, hearing aid, and vision care, and lower the cost, lower the age of eligibility. So to my mind, what infrastructure is about is not only physical infrastructure, it is human infrastructure. It is understanding that we have a life expectancy in this country. We don't talk about it very much. 39th in the world. And for lower income and working class people, the numbers are even worse. So when we talk about human infrastructure, it means doing what many countries around the world have done for years. And that is provide the basic health care and child care and paid family and medical leave that their families require.
Yeah. Senator Sanders, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you.
We are continuing to watch the scene here in Brooklyn Center, Minnesota. As events change, we'll bring you the latest. We'll be right back. And right now, we continue to follow the scene in Brooklyn Center, Minnesota. You see protesters on the streets with curfews now in effect after another fatal police shooting. As we follow that story, we're also on Update You Now on a story we reported more than 3 years ago about a young man named Billy Donovan. The story was part of a larger series we did while covering a major medical crisis that has a different sort that's also killed hundreds of thousands across this country, the opioid crisis. Well, we're sad to report tonight that Billy has passed away. Billy had dreams of being a tattoo artist and was a father to a young child. When 360's Gary Tuchman met Billy on the streets, he was 31 years old and he'd been living on the streets south of downtown Boston for a while. Billy had struggled with addiction for most of his life. He told Gary that he'd started on pills when he was 13 years old, and after that it was heroin, first snorting it, then injecting it. Addiction was such a struggle for Billy, he couldn't actually stop shooting up the first time that Gary met him.
So is it possible for you to stop shooting the heroin while we talk?
If I had gotten it in me, it would be, but...
But that's what I'm wondering, like, you feel such a strong urge that you can't stop while we talk?
Yeah. Yeah, there's nothing that would stop me. And that's how bad it gets.
Are you afraid you're going to die from this?
I know I'm going to die from this.
Well, Billy had gone through treatment many times, but he always relapsed. His mom had tried many times to get the help he needed, as so many families do. But at the time we met Billy, she wasn't sure where he was until our report. That's when some friends got him back into rehab and when Billy and his mom were able to reconnect. She told us weeks later that Billy seemed to be doing better at the detox center. At least he appeared to be staying longer than previous stints to help him kick his habit. Billy's mom, sister, and aunt were at his bedside when he died. His family's in our thoughts tonight. If you or anyone you know is struggling with substance abuse, the government runs a confidential helpline. The number is 1-800-662-HELP. Again, that number is 1-800-662-4357. The government says that last year, the number of calls they received was 27% more than the year before the coronavirus pandemic began. The news continues right now. I want to hand over to Chris for Cuomo Primetime. Chris?
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.